This is Dory Smith in the Public Affairs Department at WHUS Stores, Radio for the People at the University of Connecticut. Writer Susan Wood joins us this time to talk about her April 23rd story in Interpress News Service, IPS.org. Her title is Balancing the Iraq Equation. Her topic is Iraqi civilian casualties. Susan Wood talks about the work of Marla Rudzika, killed in Iraq while working to call attention to massive civilian deaths there. As you shall hear in this program, the latest Iraq war allocation will include a provision of some $30 million. The portion of the latest Iraq aid package will bear the name of the aid worker who inspired it, Marla Rudzika. This renowned young woman was killed in April by a car bomb on the road to the Iraq airport. Look for more news about Marla Rudzika Iraq War Victim Funds in the coming year. Our guest today, Susan Wood, has done reporting for Pacifica Radio and other progressive media outlets. She started her career as a volunteer at the station where Democracy Now! Was created, WBAI in New York. Wood then took up the challenge to report on forgotten stories in New York: hunger, homelessness, housing discrimination, alleged police brutality in minority communities, and later began reporting for Free Speech Radio News. She was FSRN's UN correspondent for 3.5 years and is now focusing on writing and her ongoing interests in progressive radio. You can find the story by Susan Wood we will talk about today at IPS.org. Susan Wood, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Susan, you heard about Marla Rudzika. Tell us about the importance of this story to you and some of your initial responses to learning of her death.
Yeah, I had never actually heard of Marla until the reports came out about her tragic death in Iraq. But I began researching her life and work, and I guess I was prompted to write the article in part because it occurred to me that most of what I was reading about her emphasized her deep compassion, her identification with the innocent victims of war, and her courage and bravery in going to war zones like those in Afghanistan and Iraq to bring direct assistance and help to war victims. But I wasn't reading an awful lot about her as a fighter. And when I read her essay that was posted on the website of the Campaign for Innocent Victims, Civic, I realized that she was, in fact, talking about political issues, that the two really were inseparable. You could not talk about war victims in Iraq without talking about the massive violence deployed by the U.S. invasion and occupation. And although she was not a political activist per se, she was a humanitarian and human rights activist, it really was clear that she believed that the United States had a responsibility, because of the violence that had been unleashed by the occupation, to recognize and compensate the large numbers of civilians being killed and maimed and injured. This was something that really was not being reported very much in all of the media accolades to her, and so I really felt that aspect of it needed to be brought out, and so I wrote about that as the introduction to my story.
Again, Marla Rudzika, the founder of the organization Civic. You can log on to civic.org and read more about this young woman, 28 years old, at the time of her death, fighting to obtain recognition and compensation for Iraqis injured in U.S. military attacks. Now, you start by saying that an accounting of civilian casualties by the U.S. government is really what's demanded here, and the death of Marla, calling attention to the fact that this is not being reported. But Marla Rudzika was on to something that goes straight to the top of U.S. politics and the military. You cite Donald Rumsfeld and Tommy Franks. Why don't you talk a little bit about her work and how it directly confronted those two leading figures in the war in Iraq?
Well, this is what I'm talking about. I mean, and any of your listeners can go to the Civic website and read the essay that was posted there a couple of days after Marla was killed. A few days after that, it appeared in USA Today. USA Today, in fact, actually wrote an editorial supporting Marla's call for the U.S. government to release statistics, which she said it had, on civilian casualties. But that really directly contradicted statements made publicly by General Tommy Franks at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan in 2002, and more recently by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. That was at a press conference last fall. In both cases saying, you know, that the U.S. military doesn't count civilian casualties, that famous phrase by Tommy Franks, we don't do body counts. But in fact, Marla had uncovered through her work, she had been, and I reported this in my article, it was reported elsewhere as well, she had uncovered evidence that, in fact, the U.S. military does keep counts. It's standard operating procedure, she was told, by someone she spoke with. She didn't name the person, a brigadier general, for soldiers to file a report when a non-combatant is shot. And in fact, she, in her research, had found that in the period between, I think, the end of February and the beginning of April, 29 civilians had been killed in fighting in and around Baghdad. But, you know, this is most likely an undercount based on studies done elsewhere. But nevertheless, it does give some kind of indication of the scale of violence there that winds up injuring civilians, you know, whether deliberately or not. And most importantly, the responsibility of the U.S. to compensate people that are injured. And this is really, I think, where the reluctance to recognize these casualties comes in, because it's extremely difficult for people who have been killed or injured through aerial bombardment or, you know, accidental shootings at checkpoints or on patrols and so forth. The U.S. military requires, this is according to an article by the Reuters news agency from earlier this month, the U.S. Does allow Iraqis to seek compensation for death or injury, but the claims have to be due, they have to prove that the injury or death was due to a non-combat situation, and they have to prove wrongful action or negligence by U.S. forces. And even then, the average payment for a civilian death is only about $4,500. So it's also extremely difficult for Iraqis to actually make these claims, because they have to travel on the airport road, which is the same road that Marla Ruzicka and her Iraqi co-workers, Faiz Salim and I don't know the name of the driver, that was not released, but that was the road they were traveling on when they were killed. It's been widely reported that a car bomb exploded, was directed against the convoy of military, of security, civilian security contractors on the road just ahead of them, and they were the target of a suicide bombing. So that's the road that the Iraqis have to travel on. It's extremely dangerous, and it's extremely difficult. And there are many who would speculate that the difficulty for Iraqis in establishing that they have had losses and have had people killed and injured is really due to the fact that the U.S. military would then be forced to compensate them.
And at the same time, Marla Ruzicka arrived in Iraq in 2003, and it was basically 2 years to the month of her death. She arrived in April of 2003, and you write a little bit about the whole story of what her life there and work meant, and we're going to be talking more about this young woman. She founded Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict, and I think it's worth noting that when she arrived in 2003, reports were just starting to make their way through the international press, and that would mean the BBC comes to mind, about the use of cluster bombs. There was an assessment going on about civilian casualties. We had guests on this program, one of whom was mentioned in your article, Michael Crist, the executive director of IPPNW, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. We had Scott Lipscomb on from Iraq Body Count. There were estimates going on. There were assessments by Iraqi doctors and international medical aid organizations, leading to a report we spoke about by MedAct. Now there's a new report by Lancet. And all of the data really talks about the same thing. The fact that the use of these massive air attacks, shock and awe, caused literally tens of thousands of deaths. And the exact numbers may never be known, but we can make estimates, and those estimates are being used right now internationally by these aid organizations trying to assess the problem. Let's go to the Lancet report that you mentioned, Susan Wood, and talk about some of what that report says and why it's so significant at this juncture.
As you mentioned, there have been a number of attempts since before the invasion by international aid organizations and human rights organizations to estimate the impact of military operations on the ground in Iraq. And it's very difficult because the situation is very, very dangerous. And these efforts haven't been facilitated in any way, of course, by the coalition forces, the so-called coalition. But there have been a number of attempts made. The Lancet study, the study that was published in The Lancet, the British medical journal, at the end of October, really stood out from these other attempts because groups like Iraq Body Count, which have done a terrific job in trying to bring to public awareness the tremendous carnage. I mean, the issue of civilian casualties basically is something, and I guess this is where I as a journalist come in. It really is something that most of our media, except for the alternative media, have pretty much ignored. You know, to read the major newspapers or listen to the network shows, you would think that there were no civilians in Iraq, only insurgents, that the U.S. Forces were fighting only insurgents. And so to get back to the Lancet study, the groups like Iraq Body Count based their estimates of the numbers of civilians killed on actual figures reported by hospitals, morgues, by the Iraqi health ministry in some cases and so forth. These estimates, however, have projected that tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians had been killed, but the estimates ranged in the low 10,000s to 20,000s. The Lancet study really stood out and it made a huge impact mostly overseas in Britain and in continental Europe, because it was a public health study that was carried out by a team of researchers from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The chief researcher, Les Roberts, had considerable experience in studying and estimating civilian deaths in the Congo. He had produced several years ago a study for the International Rescue Committee that came up with an estimate of 4 million people killed in the Congo, which was very well regarded. So Les Roberts and his collaborators, Gilbert Burnham was the other main co-author of the study, a researcher from Columbia University in New York, and researchers from Al-Mustansiriya University in Baghdad. And this was very important because without the Iraqi researchers, this study could not have been carried out. What they did was to look at representative clusters of households in 33, I believe, different neighborhoods in Iraq that were randomly selected, basically, you know, sort of computer-generated lists. And what they did was to look at mortality in these areas in the 18 months, I believe, leading up to the invasion, and then a comparable period afterwards, and compare the two. And that is how they came up with an estimate of what they called excess mortality that could only have been due to violence, and they said that this was the leading cause of death.
Let's talk about the fact that public health experts from six countries, the U.S., Britain, and others, were castigating their governments over this report, which they found very credible and, of course, meaningful because these are the organizations that need to know what's going on and need to be able to plan and understand how to deal with humanitarian crises. So, Susan Wood, do you get the sense that there's this huge divide between these two realities? You know, the one being provided in America by the mainstream press, the Bush administration, the Pentagon, and then now a growing number of people who realize that these reports have merit and should be studied as official documents about what's going on in Iraq and other places.
you know, my personal impression is it hasn't reached a critical mass yet because it just hasn't really, I think, penetrated the consciousness of most people in this country. I mean, the information is out there, and people who, in particular, have access to the Internet and can look at these different websites can get this information, but it's not being put out by the media that most people get their news from. The major networks are not covering it. In fact, when I was doing the research for my article, I did attempt to contact the major television networks, ABC News, CBS, NBC, to find out, you know, what they thought about that estimate of 100,000. That was, by the way, from last fall. And as another journalist, Lila Guterman, who's written quite extensively about the Lancet study and the Chronicle of Higher Education, and most recently in Columbia Journalism Review, as she wrote, that if those projections are accurate, then another 25,000 civilians have died, you know, since the study was published. But I did attempt to find out, you know, why media didn't consider these reports to be newsworthy. And basically, I mean, I either just didn't get a response. In one case, I did get a response from the New York Times ombudsman, Daniel Okrent. His assistant wrote me and pointed me to a column that Mr. Okrent had written in the New York Times on the issue of civilian casualties. He was quoting reporting by another New York Times reporter saying, you know, that journalists embedded with U.S. forces were exposing themselves to tremendous danger in the areas they were going into, and that it would be foolhardy to expect reporters to endanger themselves further by reporting unconfirmed information, you know, that they were not in a position to confirm. But to me, that just seems like a cop-out because, you know, we do have these studies, and the Lancet study in particular, and as I pointed out in my article, in Britain has received much wider coverage and was specifically mentioned by these public health experts from six countries who wrote in the British Medical Journal in March about the significance of this estimate and the need for further investigation and verification, which the Lancet researchers themselves also said. They said that their study had certain limitations. It excluded Fallujah, for example, because of the huge numbers of deaths resulting from the two U.S. military offenses there in April and November of last year. They had put this estimate out there, and they felt that it needed to be confirmed and that the U.S. and British military were in the best position to do that, and basically they should be doing that. And Clint McPherson, who is a leading public health expert in Britain, wrote an editorial in the British Medical Journal talking about how, in his opinion, how irresponsible it was for these two governments, the British and UK governments, to shy away from doing these investigations, establishing reliable estimates of civilian deaths and injuries, and compensating the survivors.
You know, the Iraq Body Count Group was basically doing the math that these reporters at the Times and other news outlets just simply didn't do. So they were adding up media accounts, in fact, of civilian deaths as reported in global media sources, and they very carefully did the math. They added those figures. They looked at figures from the morgues in Iraq and hospital reports that they could get a hold of and verify. So they actually were doing something very simple, and it certainly wouldn't have put reporters at risk to do what they were doing and or look at their research. But let's talk about Professor Daniel Blumenthal, the chair of the Department of Community Health at Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia. So now you note his take on civilian casualties. Why don't you talk about him a little bit?
Well, he was one of the U.S. public health experts that I interviewed when I was writing the article. I contacted nearly all of the U.S.-based and I think one of the Canadian-based signers of the petition to the U.S. and U.K. governments in the British Medical Journal from last March, and I spoke with him. And I asked him whether, in his opinion, the public health doctors, and some were not doctors, but most were, you know, whether there was any way that this could be considered a political statement and so forth, and thereby, you know, somehow minimized or denigrated. He said, first of all, civilian deaths are a public health issue and have been regarded as such for a very long time. When you're talking about deaths from any cause, the only way that you can try to control things like epidemics is to look at how people died and what they died from. And even though war is not a natural disaster, it's a human-made catastrophe, some of the same considerations apply when you're looking at mass civilian deaths from war. In other words, you have to look at what people are dying from. The use of particular weaponry, aerial bombardments in crowded civilian areas, which is what has characterized the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So he said you have to look at these things, and that's the only way that we can know. The U.S. military says that it does its best to minimize civilian casualties. We heard at the start of the war about the smart bombs that were being used that were going to just kill members of Saddam Hussein's inner circle, and we're not going to hurt civilians. And, you know, we know now that I think it was the first 50 days or something like that of the war that virtually none of the smart bombs that were dropped actually found their targets. I mean, they were dropped and they destroyed houses and they killed people, but we don't know who these people were. So what Dr. Blumenthal said was that, you know, how can we know we're making progress in minimizing civilian casualties if we don't actually go out and count and find out who the people are who died and how they died? And this is what Marla Ruzicka and her her colleagues in Iraq, the organization that she founded there, were attempting to do. And I think that this is the tremendous contribution that Marla made, was by actually going, her researchers went door to door in Baghdad and I think 9 other cities in Iraq and asked people, you know, how many people in their household had died, how they had died, or in some cases been injured. Where there were deaths, they asked to see death certificates, and they came up with a table and actually put names and faces to people who, you know, are individuals and yet are all too often, you know, kind of subsumed under this terrible phrase, you know, collateral damage. So this was the contribution that they made, helping to bring greater awareness to people in this country of the consequences of the war, but it's not enough. More needs to be done. This is what Dr. Blumenthal was saying.
Let's turn to U.S. Congress and the response of U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy, a Democrat from Vermont, to this 20-something who took it upon herself to go to Iraq and find documentation and evidence of exactly what was happening to the Iraqi people. How did he respond, and what has that all led to now, Susan Wood?
You know, I haven't actually spoken with Senator Leahy or anyone on his staff, but I do know that, you know, it's been reported that Marla went to see him in 2003 and enlisted his help in trying to get funding from, you know, some of the billions that were going for the, you know, the military, to have some of this money set aside as a special fund for Iraqi civilian victims of the conflict. And she did manage to convince him of this. A fund was set up for civilian victims in Iraq and Afghanistan. Eventually, $20 million was put into this fund, and recently I think it was announced that another $10 million had been allocated, so that makes $30 million altogether. Of course, you know, the cost of the war is many billions and billions of dollars. The U.S. Congress just approved another supplemental appropriation of $82 billion, and the civilian fund that's named after Marla Ruzicka is part of this. It's very significant because it is the first time. That is what members of CIVIC and so forth say. It is the first time that the U.S. government has acknowledged responsibility, and this is an important victory for human rights activists and others who are really struggling very hard to get some kind of accountability from the U.S. government. So it's a very, very important first step. It will be important for people in the anti-war movement to try to press to make sure that this money actually gets distributed and actually, you know, gets to the people on the ground who have been victims.
We have been talking about civilian casualties in Iraq. There are reports on the World Wide Web of what has happened as a consequence of both the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. Some of those reports can be found on the website of projectcensored.org, and Sonoma State University has now chosen the 25 most censored stories of 2005. I mention this, Susan, because one of the stories is about the Uranium Medical Research Center and their study of the use of depleted uranium and how that also has led to a humanitarian crisis of untold proportions affecting civilian populations. We also are not able to really discuss this at length. However, I think it's worth mentioning that from the civilian deaths and the horrible birth defects and other consequences of the use of depleted uranium, we can also draw conclusions about what has happened to U.S. soldiers serving in this war zone. And in fact, that is also another of the top 25 most censored stories of 2005. And there is discussion about stories by Ted Wyman, Stephanie Hiller, Bob Nichols, Juan Gonzalez, and Professor Niloufer Bhagwat, showing radiation levels in Iraqi civilians 400 to 2,000% higher than normal. The use by the United States of tons of uranium munitions in both Afghanistan and Iraq, populations there seeing gross health effects, and the fact that, again, U.S. troops are ill, and various state legislatures are now working on bills to provide funds for private testing because the federal government has not been fulfilling its mandate to both educate troops and test them for depleted uranium exposure. Talk about that aspect of it a little bit.
As we discussed, I don't consider myself an expert on this issue at all. But we all know, I think it's been well reported, that you know there was extensive use of depleted uranium in the first Gulf War. And you know many human rights activists and others who were in Iraq, people like Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness, groups that attempted to get medicine and food and other necessary supplies to the Iraqi people under the sanctions before the 2003 invasion. That was one of the main things that they were trying to make the U.S. public aware of, that the depleted uranium munitions that were used in the first Gulf War had resulted in a tremendous increase in cancer rates and leukemia. When the United Nations Children's Fund came out with its estimate that 500,000 Iraqi children had died as a result of the sanctions, you know, an estimate that was, of course, heavily criticized by the U.S. government, but nevertheless seen as authoritative elsewhere in the world. When they came out with this, I think that depleted uranium, although it was not mentioned, was in the background here because children were dying because the hospitals didn't have the medicines or the equipment to treat the cancer, the childhood cancer and leukemia that was resulting from depleted uranium. I think there needs to be a lot more public awareness and a lot more of a public outcry. And as you mentioned, the fact that U.S. soldiers in Iraq, serving in Iraq, have been exposed to depleted uranium, and that there is now movement in the state legislatures to, first of all, have this recognized and acknowledged, which is the most difficult thing of all, because the military does not like